All right, welcome. This is Talking Too Loud, the show where we talk with founders, marketers, creative leaders, really about what it takes to build breakthrough businesses, great products, and unforgettable brands. And because this is our end of the year episode, we're doing something a little different.
A little twist.
Instead of bringing on a guest, we're looking back at the moments from this year that actually made us talk too loud.
Yep.
And sometimes you snorted, so that was good.
That's true.
And we're going to go through some of the ideas we argued about, the things we quoted later, and the moments that stuck with us long after the recording ended.
Hell yeah. And some of these were big insights. Some were hot takes. Some were like kind of tiny little comments that cracked something open for us. But every single one sparked a reaction.
That's right, Sylvie. They sure did. I think we're ready to roll.
I guess I'll say one other thing.
These
aren't ranked in any particular order. So if you listen to the show this year, you'll recognize a bunch of these moments. If you're new to the show, this is kind of a crash course in what we actually talk and care about. So good for you.
Very well. Welcome. We're so glad you're here. All right, let's get into it. Loud take number one comes from a conversation we had at the very beginning of the year with Scott Belsky, who is a partner at A24 Media and formerly Adobe's chief product officer and strategy officer, and one of the best Zoom out thinkers we've had on the show. I love Scott. It's so awesome to have him on. And in this conversation, we're talking about the shift we're all feeling with content and AI and how it's making it easier than ever to produce content. And so really things are changing, right? Because if making content is no longer the constraint, then what is? And then when Scott dropped this framework, it kind of rewired the way I thought about this. So he talks a lot about the meaning economy. You may not have heard that before. And it's the simplest way I've heard someone explain what happens when creation becomes very cheap.
And so the creator economy is now, in some ways, the tools are commoditizing it. And maybe that will become the meaning economy. Now, what's the meaning economy? The meaning economy is people creating experiences that are not as scalable, but really over-index on meaning and impact, and stories that are just so transformative and incredible, or physical experiences, whether it be live events. Maybe we'll have fewer recorded podcasts and more live events with Q&A and moments where people can connect with each other and have that sort of pheromone driven live experience, that people are impacted by. So the meaning economy is interesting to me. I think that it's, yes, the tools that we're all getting excited about will contribute to it, but the human skill set suddenly becomes more important and less scalable in that world.
I think in this clip, that was the first time that I'd heard someone explain it this way.
Same. I think after this moment in the episode, I think I was like, if Scott was a cult leader, I
you
would
join
his cult.
Yeah.
Which is a bit much. But I think he touched on something that like we were feeling at the beginning of the year, but like it hadn't been named, kind of like what you said. And this idea that like, the human skill set is going to be the thing that sets people apart. That's wildly comforting to me. Like, wildly.
And it seems more true by the day, I think, right? Yeah. Like, one thing that hadn't happened back then was like, people were kind of looking at the promise of AI content, but we weren't, there's huge leaps that happened this year with generative audio. And we've seen, you can get on Sora and you can make AI videos yourself. And I think back then we didn't know how people would react. And now he was right on the money. And we basically said, like, well, if it's made with AI, and I know it's made with AI, I don't value it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And so this very interesting thing, because we're watching this happen in real time. Yeah, that was a great clip, great episode, preview of the future. I think there's more. If you were to go back and watch the whole thing, you'd find...
It's a really good episode. Yeah, and it was so prescient because we recorded that, I think, Jan 25.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was weird to like revisit that episode and be like, oh my God,
yeah,
everything Scott said was true. Okay, cool. Staying on the AI theme for a second. We just had TJ Leonard on the podcast, CEO of Storyblox. And he had one of the most human takes on this whole moment, because everyone keeps asking, is AI exciting or terrifying?
Yeah.
For me, it's both. We know this.
We know.
I'm pretty explicit about my fears, but also the excitement and the democratization of creative. Anyhow, but TJ dropped this metaphor that's so simple and so accurate, had to put it on the list.
Were you afraid of the dark as a kid? Anything like that?
A little bit. Yeah, I can definitely remember walking upstairs in my parents' house with all the lights off, and I couldn't ask Siri to turn them on, and it was being very, I would run into my room and get something and run back out.
Totally, hide under the covers, whatever. But if you were, at least for me, if I was like struggling to go to sleep, and I was like, is there something in the closet? Is there something in the bed? Like, what do you do? You like muster the courage and you like go peek under the bed, and there's like nothing there but a couple of, you know, a tennis ball. And you're like, okay, I'm cool. And we've been encouraging like our team to do the same thing. Just go look under the bed. Like, there's no boogeyman here. Like,
yeah,
go try these things. Go get hands-on. Go play with them. Make time to tinker. Because I think once we all kind of have that like light bulb moment when you're like, I wonder if I could do this. And then you just kind of go figure it out. And you're like, wow, that was really cool. And, you know, that feeling of uncertainty transitions from, you know, something that engenders fear to something, again, to your point, Chris, it's like, oh, okay, this is an opportunity. This is like, I kind of have like a new superpower here. I wonder what I can figure out next.
I thought this was like a great clip and a nice, like, kind of like almost like bookend to that first one. You know, we started the year talking about what could happen, and now like we're like experiencing this, and it is about realizing that there isn't something under the bed, and
or that there is, but the thing isn't scary.
Exactly. And then like you can take it. It's, I mean, it's like Monsters, Inc. Like you go from the thing being scary to the thing not being scary. And I think we've seen a lot of people make that transition this year. And I think we're going to have to continue to do that transition, because there's going to be more things that are new and surprising, and they're going to seem really scary at first. They're going to realize they don't work in all these cases, or they only work when a human puts them to work in the right way.
Totally. And it was just like, the visual is like so clear, you know, like you're a little kid, you're going to bed, something's in the closet. And like the only cure to that is to like go check and see. And then like once you check and see, you have this kind of revelation. And yeah, I feel like Wistia has done a great job of like dipping their toes into the AI gen tools and really making time to tinker. And I think that is what will help customers in the long run, right?
I think you're right. And I'm so glad that you feel so
I said it, not
that,
you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll just say good job. Good job, everyone. Okay, this is where we pivot from AI into brand. And honestly, this might be one of my favorite moments on Talking Too Loud. And it came when John Bonini, who's a marketing powerhouse, he's a brand consultant, asked me, why am I like this?
It's the best. I think we should just roll the tape.
Okay.
And I asked you in email, and I've used this quote a bunch of times in newsletters and you know, just podcasts like this, where I asked you, like, why are you the way that you are? Because I didn't want to get too tactical and like, why did you, like, why are you like this? Like, why will you do a parade? Why will you do 110, 100? Like, why? And you said something, I'm paraphrasing, but you said something like, we always felt like we didn't need to time the moment that somebody, you know, needed Wistia or would become a customer. We did all these other things because we felt like we'd build up, you know, affinity, and they would, when it came time, they would think of us. And yeah, so I think that's the thing right there that I kind of really zero in on and locked in on, which is like, more people need to be thinking like this, more brands need to treat their content like this. And it only became more important, I think. I went solo 2 years ago, and I think it's become more important now with AI and all this. So yeah. It's I just think it's a really powerful thing to create and kind of build momentum around.
I loved this moment. so much for so many reasons. First of all, great question.
Why are you like this?
Like, why are we? And I guess for more context, like, we were talking about, like, why brands kind of do wacky shit.
Yeah.
Or, like, things that don't make sense on paper. But, like, clearly, like, stick in people's minds. So, like, Wistia did a parade once for a product launch.
Or a pricing change.
A pricing change. And this whole conversation was just, like, kind of a love letter to brand. And, like, permission for brands to play. And it was so encouraging. Like, I feel like John has like an energy that's so like contagious.
Totally. And I mean, he and I are so aligned on this. You know, I can remember early moments where we did something that did not seem like it was going to get us customers. You know, mm-hmm. It was just like a fun, crazy thing that was often to delight ourselves, delight our parents, prove that we were a real company because we could do these things. I'll never forget, we rented a confetti cannon when we were making a front page video. We were so excited to set the confetti cannon off inside the building. And then it got mentioned so much.
Like, yeah.
Oh, your front page video is ridiculous. You guys are crazy. And then it would pivot directly from that to, and does Wistia have XYZ thing? And that's why I'm here, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel fortunate that we kind of built that muscle and figured it out early. And I think what John says at the end of the clip is also just, it is getting more and more true that brand is getting more important and more valuable, right? You need people to know who you are so then they can search for you and go get an answer and use your product or service. And I would bet that in the next few years, that's going to be even more true than it is today.
I love it. This one, I just like, I'm smiling like a fool for those who are just listening and can't see me. It just feels
you
like
you just have to imagine it.
Permission to have fun and permission to, you know, like be authentic and trust that authenticity wins. So,
yeah.
So moving right along. Also in the brand vein, I don't know why I sighed so heavily. Also in the brand vein.
We're almost done, Sylvie.
We're like barely halfway through. Yeah. We had on Bridget Putker. She's a creative consultant who describes her LinkedIn as proudly unhinged. And she kind of flipped the script on what it takes to build your personal brand. And I feel like a lot of those conversations often are like, you know, what does it take to build your personal brand? And people talk about like posting cadence and they're like giving you all these like tactics. And she's like, it's really about who you're talking to and why. And once she said it, it felt so freaking obvious, but it was like, it was an aha moment for me. So
let's play that clip.
Yeah, I think that you said the key word there, which is audience. Everybody thinks about the posting and how much you should post and what you should be saying. I'm so much more focused on who I'm saying it to. And that is why it resonates. And I've frankly always been somebody that said the quiet part out loud because I'm just confident and I have a point of view and I'm maybe say too much or maybe sometimes don't know exactly what I'm talking about. But most of the time, if I'm saying it out loud, I've done my research and I've had the experience myself.
She just jumped right into, you need to put the audience first. In what do they care about? What are they learning? What are they feeling? What's happening in their world? And then the posting part second. And I think that is exactly as you said, leading into this, like it's so easy to think that cadence is the answer. But if you have a fast cadence, a slow cadence, you're doing what everybody else does, and you don't actually have anything new or helpful or don't understand the pain that your customers have, then it's not going to work.
Totally. Yeah, I like the idea of like sort of trusting that your POV is unique and like really finding ways to honor that and share that. I think that's hard to do, like especially for younger professionals, but like when you flex that muscle, the easier it becomes.
It's funny because I found it easier at first.
Really? Mm-hmm. And now it's harder?
I would say I was so sure that my insights were new because they were new to me that I was like, I also could write things in a very simple way because it was like my first time experiencing something.
Yeah.
And then when I had tremendously more experience, it went from things feeling black and white to everything feeling gray. Mm. And so then I would try to write these very, very nuanced things, explain these nuanced things. And often it wouldn't take off the way that the stuff did.
Yeah.
And then I eventually found my way back to like, okay, these are my instincts that are the same from before. These are the things that I've, you know, turned into conviction by trying them a lot and back to a simpler place. And so it's gotten much easier. But there was a moment there. It was like easy and then really hard. And then
you like gave yourself the yips.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I think happens to everybody. It's like
totally
the curse of being an expert at something. Like you do it a lot. You know why it might not work. So you tell the person, I think it's going to work. And I'll tell you why it might not work. And then suddenly no one sees it because you've added too much in there. So yeah.
Interesting. No, that makes sense. That is an interesting sort of like challenge to the whole process. And yeah, like anything, it ebbs and flows, but.
And I think it's, you know, she's also saying she's always been the type of person unafraid to share opinions, put them out there. And I think that's another great lesson.
Oh, it's an amazing lesson.
Yeah. It's especially like, you know, you're starting, you don't even have an audience. So then sharing your stuff, it doesn't really matter if it doesn't work. Like it didn't hurt you. You know, it's like, it's actually the most freeing time to try those things.
Love it.
Look, I think we're about halfway through the episode. And I think one of the interesting things I think with the clip so far is that these moments aren't about tactics. They're about like how people think.
Yeah. And like that's kind of the through line of the show in a lot of ways. Like channels change, tools change, formats change, but the thinking underneath it all is what really matters.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I think when the thinking isn't clear, everything starts to feel kind of like a to-do list, you know, or you're just reacting. It's like, oh, I have this big list of stuff that they're doing, so I should do it. Or I've been told I should do this cadence. And so, okay, I have to change everything I'm doing. And now I'm doing writing three times a day or whatever it is. And I think this is especially true when it comes to marketing. And that's actually why Emily Kramer had one of our favorite reframes on the show. And she calls this random acts of marketing. And her antidote isn't to do more. It's actually pick fewer bets and make sure that they're big enough to actually matter.
Chaotic marketing is random acts of marketing. It's when you do everything that someone ever requests of you or that any company ever does, or a company that you're like, this company's doing great. Let's do exactly what they did, or let's buy all these billboards, or let's do name whatever new tactic of the day. And like the problem is that you have a unique audience and you're at a unique stage and you have unique advantages as a company and unique disadvantages. And you need to take things, those things into consideration before you just start doing a checklist of things. But I always tell people like you have to plan for impact and you need to make strategic bets. And yes, you're going to be testing things, but everything you need to test needs to have a chance to be a big winner for you and to drive meaningful growth.
Nailed it.
It's so true, though. I mean, when she was talking about, you know, kind of making big strategic bets, that's like your love language.
It really is. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, think of marketing as each bet is like an investment in a VC portfolio that can return the fund. Come on.
That is
right down the strike zone. I loved it.
Catnip. Yeah. That's your catnip.
Yeah, love it.
It was, you know, it was a different way of thinking about marketing strategy. It just was like, oh yeah, like they are investments and they should be intentional. They should not be like, oh, brand A is doing this, so I have to do this. It's like, what makes sense for you? What makes sense for your company? What makes sense for your customers? Don't chase the shiny thing. Which is so easy to do. It's so tempting.
It's do the things that are uniquely good for you that have the potential to really scale. And that you, often those things are hard. And so then it's like, you really can't do all of them. And you do everything under the sun. You focus in and we underestimate what can happen when those things actually work. And so, yeah, that whole episode was so great. Another recent one. Definitely encourage you to go check it out.
Love that episode. Definitely check out the full. Another thing that kept coming up this year is that even if you have a great strategies fall apart sometimes if you don't understand your customers, if you don't understand the people. So nobody knows this
preach,
better.
Somebody, preach.
Oh no, we're back in that mode. Oh Jesus. Yeah, nobody knows that better than Talia Wolf, who's a conversion expert. And she was like very vehemently passionate about the fact that like customers' decisions aren't logical, they're emotional. Surprise, even in B2B.
Surprise.
We're running A-B tests, we're trying to optimize, we're trying to drive more conversions, leads, sales, whatever. And we're just not getting any results. And it's so frustrating because, you know, you're reading all the blog posts, you're like following the best practices, you're reverse engineering whatever your competitor did. And like, this is going to work. And every time we'd launch and zilch, nothing, nada. Yeah. And then for me, it was kind of a light bulb moment where I was like, okay, what is a conversion? What is a conversion? I'm like, oh wait, it's a decision. And I think that moment of me saying, oh, what I need is to understand decisions. Like, how do people make decisions? And then that will make it so much easier for us to optimize funnels because we'll know how people make decisions, what they care about, what they don't, and we'll help them make a good decision for themselves. And that's where emotional targeting comes in because that's when I started to uncover that every decision that we make in life is based on emotion. So if I want to actually understand how our customers make decisions, I need to understand their emotional drivers.
I mean, yet another example, when it all comes back to an individual person and their actual experience, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about conversions on an A-B test inside of a grid when you're looking at a sheet of nameless users. It's an actual human being on the other side of the screen who is making a decision. And then when you understand that, of course, human beings are going to use emotions to help them make decisions. We do that, especially with complex ones. We do that as much as we like to think we don't. We are very emotional beings. And yeah, this whole episode I felt was so good and something that's like, just we could scream from the rooftops about the role that emotional decision-making has in B2B. And I think it just gets forgotten so often. It's so easy to ignore.
You said it all. You took the words out of my mouth. Thank you. No, I thought this was like a real sort of wake-up call for people who have become sort of only data-driven. It's like data only tells you part of the story. You got to dig deep to understand the why. And yeah, I loved Talia's whole framework. She was great. Best accent of the season.
Your favorite accent.
Sorry, okay. Phil Nottingham, another.
Nottingham, okay.
Another Brit.
Let's jump to our next clip, which is from our most popular episode on Spotify this year.
According to Wrapped.
And in it, we talked with Nancy Harhut, who she is a behavioral science marketer who's done a ton of research on why we buy, click, and act the way that we do. And this is the moment that stuck with us.
I was doing some research for the book, and I kind of came upon this this principle called autonomy bias. And it's this idea that we all have this deep-seated, hardwired desire to exert some kind of control over ourselves and our environments. I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then, you know, I dug a little bit more, and it's like, well, basically it means we don't like to be told what to do. We don't like to be forced into doing things. We like to feel like we're the ones who are making the call. And there was a bit of research that was done in a nursing home, right, a facility for older people. And what they did is, some people were given a movie to watch every week, and they had a plant in their room, and hey, that's pretty cool, right? I get a movie every week. I've got someone who's got this plant in my window, and they come in and they care for it. Other people were given a choice of, you know, several different movies, and they could choose the movie they wanted that week. And they were given a plant, put it on the windowsill, but they were the ones who had to kind of care for it. And when the researchers came back like a year later, half of the people who had been given the movie and given the plant that was taken care of were dead. And the people that still were allowed autonomy, that could choose which movie they wanted, that were told, hey, you're the one who's going to water, they were still alive. And the researchers were like blown away, right?
Wow.
And
so my God.
It was amazing, right? And so the researchers said that like this need for autonomy is really deep seated, and wow. We can start to take it away from people, and it does track with some other research about, you know, people feeling happiest at jobs when they feel they have purpose, when they feel that they're making a meaningful contribution, right? You know, so one of my favorites, you know, I mean, we're talking about marketing, we're not talking about keeping people alive, but one of my favorites is
same difference,
close enough, right? Yeah, right. You know, one of my favorite go-to tactics is the idea of autonomy bias, you know, giving people choices. And a lot of times in marketing, we're so focused on a personalized recommendation. You know, we're going to do the work for you. We're going to make it easy for you. We're going to tell you exactly what it is you need. This is the one for you, Chris, and this is the one for you, Sylvie. And, you know, you're much better off as a marketer giving it, you know, like three choices, saying, hey, Chris, here are three we've chosen for you. Sylvie, here are three that we think would be really great for you. And then I'm still making it easy for you. I'm not saying here's 300 or here's 30, but you're still making the choice.
I mean, just watching that clip back, it hit me again. It's crazy, right?
That, like every time.
It's just so, such a remarkable thing. It's like, people, we need autonomy so badly that when they did this test, the people who didn't have it died and the people who had it didn't.
Like,
is so.
It's just so. It's just dark.
Even when you know it's in there. I know a clip we're pulling. I know, but watching her say it, it's just something else. I mean, I think. And yeah, it is so interesting because we all think that hyper personalization is the secret. And if you do hyper personalization, you don't give people a choice, they're not going to like it.
Not going to like it. Yeah, it is. Damn. every time I get so stuck on this example that she pulled, because it was, I mean, it blew our minds and continues to blow our minds. But yeah, the hyper-personalization thing I think is so interesting because it feels like that's what a lot of companies are doing now. Like, we have this exact thing that you, Sylvie, need for X.
Yeah.
And really what Nancy is saying is that company would be better off being like, Sylvie, we have three things that we think you might like. Take a gander.
Yeah.
You choose. And I love that.
Yeah.
I want to choose.
You love
I'm way. I, yeah.
Give you the choice.
Give me the choice to do stuff.
Okay. We have one more loud take. I think the loudest take of the year.
Good. Because we're getting unhinged again.
We're getting unhinged. This is not a controversial take, I don't think. This is more like tried and true. This one stuck with us. I know you're expecting some really crazy thing.
Yeah. It's not contrarian. It's just like such a good little nugget, and it's shaped how we think about video and content and honestly the show itself.
Yes. So this came from our conversation with Adam Adelakin, founder of A2 Media. And it's his answer to a deceptively simple question. What actually makes a story work?
I asked one of my friends, his name's Darren Fenton. He worked in Hollywood for about 10 years. And I said to him, if you had to highlight one key thing for storytelling, what would it be? And he said, transformation. And I was like, bro, did you answer this question before? Like, how did you have that so quickly? And he was like, if you can speak to the transformation or show a transformation from bad to good, or from, you know, unhealthy to healthy, those are the stories that people lock into. And you have to demonstrate some form of transformation in any story that you tell. And I was like, that is like my guiding force for anyone that tells stories now. I'm like, where are you taking people from and where are they going? We have to put that in there in some capacity. And it has never steered me wrong.
I mean, nailed it.
It's just... it's simple and so affecting. It's like, yeah, you need to show the change.
You need to show the change. And I mean, it creates the stakes, right? So you care. Because if someone's in one position, it could be your business, it could be the state of your product. Mm-hmm. It could be some challenge you're going through. It can mm-hmm. be something your customer is experiencing. Like, if you can help set up the stakes, like, why does this matter? I hope we can get through the transition. Then you can tell a story where people stick with you and they actually care. And ultimately, hopefully, they're along for the journey.
That's what they're there for. They're coming for the journey.
What do you think our biggest transformation was this year?
Love that question. I've thought about this a bit. So like, we started the show in the pandemic, right? And we started as an audio show because video shut down, which was weird because Wistia is a video company. Mm-hmm. And I came from an audio background. That's what I knew. And I think maybe a year into doing the show, we pivoted to video. Mm-hmm. And it was a hard adjustment for me. Mm-hmm. Like hard.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I remember well.
More just like, yeah, being on camera, thinking about, you know, visual language. Like there was a lot to kind of take in. And I know that's your wheelhouse. You felt very comfortable. But I feel like this year, the biggest transformation has been like finding our groove in the video world. And we're by no means like going viral on YouTube, but we've learned some stuff. We've learned some stuff. And what we're seeing, sort of the change that we're seeing, is average longer watch time. It's gone up significantly. And that has to do with finding a real rhythm with video.
I also think we really have leaned into where is the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 years ago, we'd make the episodes and sometimes we'd make clips. And now every time we have an episode, we make a lot of clips. We put the clips in different places and they're tweaked for different places. And, you know, if you were to follow Talking Gillette on TikTok, you'll see we're growing a lot and the audience is really starting to show up there. And there's, I'm seeing similar things like that on Instagram, Sylvie. And
it's a different beast. Instagram is...
It's totally different, but we're seeing like very interesting things. And obviously we've seen it on LinkedIn. So I think we've transformed it and actually thought of it more even as a product, like every episode as its own product, thinking about like, you're making the product. How are you going to talk about it? What are people going to react to? What are they going to like? What are they not going to like? And I'll also say for anyone consuming this, watching it, listening, like, thank you. Like you're the people who are giving us the feedback and helping us figure out how to tweak the show. And I mean, we love doing it. It's so fun, but also like we love doing it and it's so fun because like you actually react and you send us emails and you give us comments and you tell us about how it's impacted your day to day. And yeah, that just makes it all feel worth it. So it's been a transition on like the media type and getting good at it. And also I feel like a transformation in terms of how we think about where the audience is and what we want to give them.
So well said.
But we have one more transformation, Sylvie.
We do? Oh no, surprise. This is, I don't know about.
Because this is also the year that we won our first Signal Award.
You got it!
Yeah, this is the gold one. So this is for best business episode.
Yeah. With Eric Paley. We did not tease a clip from that episode in this episode, but you should listen to it because we won a gold award. Don't you want to know what we won a gold award?
Why did we win that award? Well, this episode will tell you.
No, it's been a blast this year. We learned a ton. We're still learning. Super pumped for 2026.
Yeah.
We'll be back January 13th.
Perfect. Yeah. So we'll see you in the new year. Happy holidays, everybody. Enjoy, relax, watch some old TTL, you know.
Get loud at the dinner table.
Yeah. That's it. I think we've got to go.
Okay.
Bye, Sylvie. Bye, everybody.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.